Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, and the national debt, and more. You'll hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. This is a special edition of Facing the Future with your regular host, Chase Hageman, out for another week of paternity leave. I'm the Concord Coalition's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and I'll be pinch-hitting again for Chase this week. Today, I'll be joined on the show by Joe Minerick, Senior Vice President and Director of Research at the Committee for Economic Development. Joe has a wealth of experience. He was the Chief Economist at the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, for all 8 years of the Clinton administration, and he will tell us he managed to balance the budget, and he and his mother are both very proud of that fact. And prior to that, Joe worked with Senator Bill Bradley on tax reform. He served as chief economist to the House Budget Committee. He also served as staff director for the Joint Economic Committee. Recently, he served on the Bipartisan Policy Center's Debt Reduction Task Force, which I was also a member of, and I guess it wasn't all that recent, but it seems like it was recent. And Joe also served on the National Academy of Sciences, Our Fiscal Future Project. That, along with the BPC project, are two efforts on trying to reduce the federal deficit. Joe has a PhD in economics from Yale University and writes a regular post for CED's blog, In the Nation's Interest. And I should also add that Joe is a charter member of the Concord Coalition's Fiscal Wake Up Tour. Joe, welcome back to, and you've been a prior guest here, so I will say, Joe, welcome back to Facing the Future.
Bob, it's always a pleasure and to go through all that history and all the stuff we did and for all that we've accomplished so far.
Well, and so for all of those efforts, the deficit is going to crack $10 trillion next year and $12 trillion over the next 10 years. But it's not our fault. No, seriously, it is worth noting that when you left the Office of Management and Budget and turned lights out after 8 years, we had a pretty big surplus, and people were wondering what we were going to do without any debt.
Oh, it was a matter of serious worry on the parts of some people. Would that we were so lucky. But I've said ever since, when I was in the White House, we were buying bonds instead of selling them. It was a different world.
It was a different world. And it seems like it wasn't that long ago, but it was several trillion dollars ago, I guess, in debt.
Indeed.
Let's fast forward to the immediate future here. Before we think about some of the longer term stuff, Congress has a problem. In a couple of weeks, November 21st to be precise, funding for the federal agencies will run out, and because we're into the fiscal year and Congress hasn't passed the 12 annual appropriation bills, it's kind of a tricky situation this year because they're also playing impeachment hearings. So the White House is kind of dug in, and it's a very highly partisan atmosphere. But let's just look at the appropriations. We got funding running out in a couple of weeks, less than 3 weeks anyway, and none of the bills passed yet. What seems to you a likely scenario?
Well, we're as you know, the Congress can't always walk and chew gum at the same time. And now they've set themselves a task, I think, fairly described as sprinting and juggling at the same time. This is going to be a really difficult circumstance. The White House and the Democratic leadership in the House have managed to agree upon a total amount of appropriated spending, which will be a significant increase over last year. However, they can't tap that money until they pass appropriations bills. So as you noted a moment ago, the September 30th deadline for filing appropriations will occur on November 21st, which is a measure of how surreal this situation is. There is an incentive for the two sides to come to an agreement because it enables them to spend that additional sum of money. But the problem, as always, is that you can only spend each one of those dollars once. And as a result, with the two sides fighting with each other over what those dollars should be used for, they're going to have a very hard time coming to an agreement. In particular, the White House wants a minimal amount of money, $5 billion is the number that's being discussed, to be devoted to the border wall between the United States and Mexico. If the $5 billion goes to that border wall, the Democrats can't use that money for other things that they would very much prefer to do. So it looks as though, number one, there's a very high probability that rather than coming to an agreement now, the Congress and the White House will be able to agree only to punt until some point in the new year, at which point they will face exactly the same problem that they're facing now, perhaps in a different stage of the impeachment dilemma. It's really hard to, it's a coin toss whether they are going to complete actual appropriations or whether they are somehow going to have to come up with just some extender bill, some long-term continuing resolution that takes them through the rest of the year. Continuing resolutions generally stick to last year's levels, and that would mean they would lose out on the additional total money that they were willing to agree to spend, but that they haven't yet decided how to allocate. It's a bizarre situation and very hard to imagine where we're going.
An interesting situation. They agree to spend more money and then you don't get to spend it because you're fighting over how to spend it on what it gets spent on.
Exactly.
But it does seem like the border wall is, that was what caused the partial disagreement about that. And there's a lot of added hostility, even if we weren't talking about impeachment. I just think the way that Congress, including Republicans, did not want to fund the wall, and then the president declared an emergency, which a lot of people looked at as sort of a dubious technicality that was not intended for that purpose, and took some money from the Pentagon budget to spend on the border wall. And so I think the Democrats came back and said, well, no, they're not going to do that again. And so even if we didn't have, I think that fight would be there even if we weren't talking about impeachment, which really makes me wonder if they're going to be able to get anything done without like a full year continuing resolution.
I mean, every way you look at this problem, you find some other roadblock. You've described one of them very well. Let me just mention another. There is something about this presidency, and some people will blame it on the president. Some people will blame it on the people who are opponents of the president. But somehow, all of these major differences wind up being real arm wrestling, mano a mano, winner take all contests, where if either side gives in, they have somehow lost their identity. And that makes it really hard to come to an agreement. You know, we think back to past decades when people found a way, if somebody wanted zero and somebody else wanted 10, they could find their way to five.
This didn't used to be that difficult.
Exactly.
Yeah, everybody would assume that there would be a deal.
Exactly. And here we are, where either side giving an inch somehow symbolically is a total defeat.
Yeah, I sometimes wonder how our co-founder Warren Rudman would, in his appropriations days, this would boggle his mind. I mean,
it certainly would.
This is Facing the Future. I'm Bob Bixby, and I'm talking to Joe Minerick, Senior Vice President and Director of Research at the Committee for Economic Development. We've been discussing the prospects of a government shutdown, which we're both somewhat pessimistic about. So why don't we move on to another topic? Recently, the most recent economic figures showed that the economy was still growing, albeit at a slower rate, about 1.9%. And that number in the last quarter, that number did strike me because it's consistent with the long-term growth projections from the Congressional Budget Office and the Federal Reserve and others. And I wonder if we're now seeing a settling back in to the pre-tax cut norm, which is a slower rate than we used to think of as the usual for economic growth. But, you know, we had the big tax cut in 2017. There was a big burst in 2018 for a while. I mean, the growth was, I think, about 2.9% for the year. But now it's trending back downward. How do you view these numbers?
I think you've got the essence of it, Bob. Of course, what we're dealing with over a very long period of time is a declining rate of growth of our labor force. That is a reality that we just have to deal with. You go back.
And that happens whether you cut taxes or raise taxes.
This is a fact of nature. There's nothing much you can do about it. If what we're talking about is kids going to school up to age 21 and going into the labor force in the age of 22, there's no way to invent more 21-year-olds. We've got what we've got over a two-decade horizon going forward. We used to talk back in the 1950s and the early 1960s about aggregate growth of 4% in total, which would be a 2% productivity growth and 2% growth in the labor force, to use very, very round numbers. We're now down to the point where growth in the labor force is well under 1%, under half of a percent, really. So a lot of that potential growth has just gone away. And there is, again, nothing we can do about it. Let's give President Trump his due. He did stomp on the accelerator with that tax cut at the end of 2017. There were some folks who believed that our labor force was already stretched to the breaking point. We did, in fact, have some subsequent increase in employment, so the economy did grow a little bit faster in 2018, as you suggested. But we're now getting back to what appears to be the feasible limit of this economy, with a rate of labor force growth of barely over zero. We can get 2% productivity growth, and we wind up with 2% total economic growth.
Which is about where we are at the moment.
It's about where we are. And the problem that we face long term is that out of that lower total amount of additional economic growth, we have this growing population of elderly who expect to be supported. They're going to get Social Security benefits. They're legally due. They're going to be protected through Medicare. That's in the law. And we also have all the other things this country wants to do, including sending our young people to school and giving them a good education. We have challenges in terms of national security. We have an aging infrastructure base. We need protection of the rule of law, et cetera, et cetera.
There's stuff that needs to be funded.
The stuff that we have to do. And we are stretching on what this economy is capable of producing. And that is going to be an issue going forward. And we go down this list of necessities. And the next thing we know, we're running large budget deficits, and we haven't addressed that problem. And we can only run the debt up so far.
I think this is really the thing that always gets me when I look at it, is at the time that you're building up these bigger expenses associated with an aging population and the other things that you mentioned, but it's the aging population, healthcare that is putting some automatic increases into the federal budget, and yet the economy has slowed from its steady state from maybe around 3% to 2% for reasons that you mentioned. And so you got lines going in the wrong direction. We're going to take a break here. This is Facing the Future. I'm your guest host this week, Bob Bixby, and I'm talking to Joe Minarek, Senior Vice President and Director of Research at the Committee for Economic Development. We've been discussing government shutdowns and the prospects of tax cuts, and soon we're going to be talking about Medicare for All. We'll be right back after these short messages to hear more from Joe. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm Bob Bixby, substituting for your regular host, Chase Hageman, who is on paternity leave. We're picking up on our last segment with Joe Minarek, Senior Vice President and Director of Research at the Committee for Economic Development. We've been discussing, in the last segment, we were talking about the economy, and Joe, one of the things, you know, we were talking about the economy settling back in at about a 1.9% growth rate adjusted for inflation, which is in line with the projections that most official nonpartisan sources have made. One of the ideas that we saw floated in the press this week here in Washington was the idea of maybe doing another tax cut next year, whenever. The idea was pretty vague, not a lot of specifics on it, but just the idea of, well, gee, we need a tax cut maybe to goose up the economy going into the election. Just as an economic proposition, what is the case for a tax cut at this time?
You're reminding me of a famous saying, which is often misattributed. The saying is that prediction is very difficult, especially if it is about the future.
And I would say it was by Yogi Berra.
But in fact, the best information is the person who said that was a Nobel Prize winning physicist by the name of Niels Bohr, a contemporary of Albert Einstein in on the ground floor of nuclear theory. If I told you that Yogi Berra said that, we'd all laugh and move on. If I told you that a Nobel Prize winning physicist said that, we'd scratch our heads and think there's got to be something in there beyond the obvious superficial sense of humor.
Could Niels Bohr catch for the Yankees?
Certainly not. Certainly not. But think about it a little bit. You know, we very often in economics and in other fields pretty much assume that if you impose a treatment upon the world, you get a result, you go back and you impose the same treatment again, you expect the same result. Well, not necessarily. The last tax cut enacted in 2017 did in fact get us somewhat faster economic growth, no increase in inflation that we could see. There's an assumption that if we do the same thing again, we're going to get the same result, but the world changes. As another thinker once said, the Greek philosopher Heraclitus, you can never step into the same stream twice because the stream is always changing. With the flowing of the water, the banks are altered. With the development of our economy, the potential result from a tax cut is going to change as well. And you can only push so long and so hard before you actually get, potentially you're bumping your economy up against its potential output, its potential to produce. And you wind up just driving prices higher as different producers who want to hire workers, and they're all bidding for the same workers, and they just bid the prices up. And those higher wages feed into the prices of the products. So why are we doing a tax cut or talking about doing a tax cut in an election year? One certainly has to recognize that tax cuts are very popular politically. There is, of course, the presumption that if we do another tax cut, we're going to get faster economic growth again. The results, however, could be different. There is no way that you can impose tax cut after tax cut after tax cut without eventually banging the economy up against the ceiling and hurting.
At the same time, spending is going up. So you're most of it on autopilot for things we talked about before. But the effect of the last tax cut is coming into a little bit sharper focus here. One of the promises was that it would spark long-term growth. So we shouldn't worry about the short-term deficit effect because it would make for a stronger economy over the long term. And it would do so by encouraging businesses to invest more. The interesting thing about the numbers is that business investment has been down, as I understand it, for several quarters now. The elixir doesn't seem to be working there.
Yeah, it is very hard to find anything in the data since that tax cut was enacted that tells you that this tax cut, this past tax cut, is going to pay for itself in the long run. It's just, there's no sign of that. The debt has been mounting, the deficit has been higher every year. And now if we're talking about another tax cut, you know, that is the one respect where I think we would expect that if we do the same thing again, that aspect of the result is going to repeat itself. And as you note, we do not have much more capacity to add to the debt before we start really worrying about the stability of our nation's financial system.
This is Facing the Future. I'm Bob Bixby, and I'm talking to Joe Minarek, Senior Vice President and Director of Research at the Committee for Economic Development. And Joe, we've been, okay, so we went through the appropriation stuff, and not a whole lot of good news there. We went through the economic growth numbers and the prospect of tax cuts, and some problems there. So let's talk about something non-controversial like Medicare for All.
Absolutely. We can all agree on that.
Senator Elizabeth Warren did put out a proposal for how she would pay for it after being challenged on that by some of her competitors. But I want to step back and just, I know you at CED have looked a lot at Medicare. What's your take on the concept of Medicare for All?
I think that, Bob, you and I talk about things where we could agree. I think you and I would come to a conclusion that the only way that we are going to deal with the nation's long-term fiscal problem, and we're talking here about rising healthcare costs that are burdening not only government budgets, not just the federal government, state, and even local governments, business budgets, and household budgets all at the same time. Healthcare costs are growing faster than our collective income is. So what's going on here is we have got to find a way to deliver quality health care at lower cost. If we can't do that, we are very soon going to face two alternative ugly futures, and you know, we might be lucky and get both of them. One is overflowing government budgets and overflowing debt. And the second is facing the necessity to cut back on the healthcare that we make available to people because we simply can't afford to provide care without limit because care is becoming more and more expensive. Possibly higher and higher qualities, we can argue about the problem that we don't do a very good job of keeping people healthy in the United States. When they get sick, we do a very good job of fixing them, but we don't do a very good job of keeping people healthy and therefore keeping the total cost down. So when we look at the options that we face, we've got to find a way to make the delivery of quality healthcare more efficient. I think we can probably agree that if you look out across the society and try to find the mechanisms for delivering quality healthcare at low cost, we come up with a list of private healthcare delivery systems, the Mayo Clinic, Kaiser Permanente, the CalPERS insurance system in California. You can name the deliverers of healthcare that are of high quality. Medicare for All, in pursuit of trying to cover everybody, would eliminate each of those high quality, high efficiency delivery mechanisms for healthcare. Now, how is that going to lead us to a more efficient, lower cost, high quality healthcare delivery system? If we take all the leaders in that field and mow them down in the interest of putting everybody on old fashioned, inherently inflationary fee for service medicine, that's a problem. And that is the one thing that really bothers me about the prospect of a Medicare for All system.
Well, I look at the proposals for funding, and I think there's been a lot of talk about the one that was just put out. As I understand it, it starts with a certain baseline, as we all do, of projected spending, and then assumes that through various, just by having all one system, you would have administrative cost savings and payment savings, because the system would pay less to doctors and hospitals than the private system. It would pay it basically at Medicare rates, and Medicare doesn't pay as high as private systems. So it begins with an assumption that you're going to save about a third of our current baseline right off the top from that. So that's kind of a big assumption as to whether or not you can do that with physicians and doctors. It works mathematically, but whether or not it works practically is a real big question. But then the questions of, even if that works, you're left with $20.5 trillion under this particular plan to finance. I started looking at the details of that, and a lot of it, I mean, there are some what I would call like old hardy chestnuts, like we're going to cut back on waste and we're going to close the tax gap by collecting, you know, money that the IRS doesn't collect now because of waste. And we're going to cut back on defense spending, which is, if you look at it closely, that's an annual appropriation, not an ongoing entitlement. So you really can't offset one with the other. But have you looked at this particular plan and have any observations on its financing?
Well, we're talking here about Senator Warren's attempt to articulate how she's going to implement and pay for Medicare for All. You know, one thing that she did was to start from the premise that she would not increase taxes on the middle class. Now, the middle class, if you're in fact saying that you're going to give comprehensive health insurance coverage with no co-pays, no deductibles, and no premiums, the middle class is saving a lot of money. Logic might suggest that part of that money might be put back into the system to pay for that, and middle class people would still be big winners. But if you are starting under the banner that there will be no increases in middle class taxes, you're reaching for a lot of tools that are probably not very well designed for this task. And you mentioned really a couple of them, and there are others, you know, taxes on wealth, taxes on financial transactions, a whole lot of reliance on tax vehicles that don't bear on health insurance and quite are untried, are not necessarily going to be very successful.
So one of the things that and this is true, you know, of the Medicare for All or single payer system in general. By the way, I don't like the term Medicare for All. I don't think that what's being proposed in the single payer system is Medicare for All. Medicare has a lot of features like co-pays and deductibles, and it has private insurance plans through Medicare Advantage, and has a payroll tax that pays for things. And it doesn't have the comprehensive coverage that this plan would have. So, I mean, I do object to that. And I've made this point on this podcast, and people are probably sick of me saying it. But But let's, for the sake of the argument, we'll call it that because that's colloquially what it's been called. But for the single payer system, the argument is made that we're already paying this amount. It's just a matter of who's paying it. So Medicare for All would not be more expensive because the general public is already paying, or states are paying, or something when you add it all up. And I'd ask you to comment on that, but one comment I have on it is that it may be perceived as a different thing if you're paying healthcare premiums that you may have a say in, you know where it's going to. If you convert that into a tax, you would be paying a tax. And so it's everything going to the federal government rather than people having some element of choice in their healthcare plans. And I'm not sure that politically, even if it adds up to the same thing, if you convert all that into a tax, it does seem to me that would be more politically problematic. Anyway, people notice taxes perhaps more than they notice a healthcare premium.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. One of the problems that any insurance or healthcare reform proposal is going to have to deal with is that most Americans, if you look at the polls that are out there, most Americans are pretty happy with the healthcare they have now. And redesigning the entire system and forcing all of those people who are happy to go and look for fundamentally different plans really is an awful lot of dislocation. The other point which you've raised, and I think it bears emphasis, in terms of changes in the availability of care to people, in terms of changes in the reimbursement of physicians and hospitals, and in terms of new and untried tax vehicles, we are talking about uncertainty between the cost and the revenue sources of Medicare for All, where the uncertainty is really measured in trillions of dollars over 10 years. This is an enormous leap of faith. And if the calculations turn out to be wrong, and they may very well be, just think about reimbursing the entire healthcare industry on the basis of a fee schedule, which right now in Medicare is under enormous challenge. There are people who do not believe that providers can actually recover their costs under the current Medicare program and need to cross-subsidize by overcharging private payers. Now you're talking about taking that schedule or something very much like it and putting the entire system on top of it.
And I should note that the chief actuary of the Medicare system every year has a special report in the Medicare trustees report that basically says, we don't think the assumptions made in this report are sound.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the actuarial assumptions, but the payment assumptions, which assume deep cuts or very aggressive cost savings measures, which were enacted into law, but which many, as you pointed out, many don't think are feasible. And these are the assumptions now that these plans would rely on. So really a difficult dilemma for us as we try to figure out how to, control healthcare costs across the board. And this is, I guess, the gamble in the Medicare for All or single payer is that it's best done by having one entity do that. And I suppose by fiat that could be done, but you'd lose, as you said, the competition. I do worry about that. I mean, it does seem like competition is a good thing in our society, and maybe we don't have it very well done, quite the right way in healthcare. It's not a typical market, so you can't have, you can't just say, well, let competition decide everything because it's a different sort of a market. But that's a different thing from saying let's eliminate competition altogether.
Yeah, let me make one observation on that. I'm not a big fan of the Affordable Care Act. I don't believe that that is the system that will take us into the sunset with health care that we can afford and that delivers high quality. There have been some changes, however, that were imposed by the Affordable Care Act that I think can be extremely important going forward, including things like requiring insurance plans to sign up individuals regardless of their pre-existing conditions, preventing insurance companies from dropping patients on the basis of trivial errors of fact on their applications, something that was called rescinding coverage and allowing insurance companies to do that. We have rules now which, if they were applied to a system going forward with private healthcare plans that are like what people now use and with which they're satisfied, could be required. Those plans could be required to deliver care to everybody, regardless of pre-existing conditions. We have systems of reinsurance, what is sometimes called risk adjustment, so that plans that took care of a lot of sick people would get some additional premium revenue to reimburse them from those extraordinary costs. There is a way to take a system, to create a system that is not so radical a change as quote unquote Medicare for all, that does not give all of the responsibility to government, which to this date has not been successful in delivering high quality care at limited cost. For all the success of Medicare in providing guaranteed coverage, it hasn't really done a good job of doing that on a sustainable basis. We could do something that is closer to the system that we have today that would cover everybody. Having universal coverage is not a determinant of, it does not say without any alternative that we have to have a public system, a federal government system of providing care and coverage. We can do that in different ways. And we really need, before we plunge into Medicare for all, or even we waste 2 years of a Congress's time discovering that Medicare for all doesn't work, we ought to be thinking about alternatives.
Well, Joe, we're going to have to wrap things up for now, but I know that CED has written extensively on that subject. If people want to look at CED's recommendations for healthcare, where should they go?
They can go to CED, Committee for Economic Development, CED.org. And we have a tab for health, and they can hit that and they can see our recommendations for the healthcare system for Medicare and for the healthcare system for our working age population and their dependents. We have plans on similar principles to cover both of those groups.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby, and I've been talking to Joe Minerick, Senior Vice President and Director of Research at the Committee for Economic Development. Joe, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
You have been Facing the Future. This is Bob Bixby, substituting for Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.